from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Dave Iverson. Film critic David Thompson may be one of the most prolific film critics to walk the earth. He's written more than 20 volumes on his favorite topic. His latest book is Moments That Made the Movies. It's a series of love letters to his favorite scenes from 72 films. When you think about it, we don't really remember our favorite films. We remember specific moments, like this one.
Where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
What stars align to make a scene work like that? Why do some resonate with us so powerfully years after the fact? If anyone can answer these questions, it's film historian David Thompson. He joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Dave Iverson. Certain movie scenes are so good, you remember them as clearly as if they happened to you. Sometimes the scene is from a phenomenal work of art. Sometimes it's a rare moment of glory in a filmic disaster. Sometimes you haven't even seen the film, but the moment has entered the cultural lexicon. Almost everybody, for instance, has been exposed to this moment from Casablanca.
Everybody is to leave here immediately. This cafe is closed until further notice. Clear the room at once.
How can you close me up? On what ground?
I'm shocked. Shocked.
That isn't the scene, although there are a lot of scenes in Casablanca. Let's try another one. One chosen by the film historian David Thompson, author and film critic for The New Republic. We're talking with him today about his new book, Moments That Made the Movies. So here again, hopefully, is another clip from Casablanca.
Play it once, Sam, for all time's sake.
I don't know what you mean, Miss Elsa.
Play it, Sam. Play as time goes by.
Oh, I can't remember it, Miss Elsa. I'm a little rusty on it.
I'll hum it for you.
So many moments in Casablanca. How did you choose this one, David Thompson?
Almost at random, if you know what I mean. It's a film of moments. It's a film. It's sort of like Shakespeare plays. They're full of quotations. And Casablanca now is known bit by bit, bite by bite. Obviously, there had to be something from Casablanca.
And yet they didn't think they were making a Shakespeare play. They thought they were churning out sausage.
Well, Shakespeare didn't know he was making a Shakespeare play, probably. I mean, he thought he was just putting on a show, which I think is probably the best recipe for making something that will last a long time. I think if you know you're doing greatness at the time, you probably aren't doing it. If you think you're doing work, there's a chance that it will last.
So dig into this scene for us. What is it about that moment that makes it a great moment, a memorable moment?
Well, it uses the song to evoke the whole past between Rick and Ilse. It's based on the close-ups of Dooley Wilson and Ingrid Bergman, obviously, a lovely tune. And the fact that we sort of know Bogart is there off-screen, likely to hear it, so that when he comes in, he's going to be changed. The thing I like about it, the thing that I think works with the theme of this book, is that it's a moment where the threads of a film are pulled together. And you know, you sort of say as it happens, oh, this is it. It's like the bottom of the ninth where a big hitter comes up, bases loaded. You suddenly know the game is going to be decided. We may go to extra innings, but still something big and significant is going to happen. And I think that's a very important part of moments in films that you remember, that we can hold on to, that the film shifts. It maybe identifies itself. It's in this moment, really, that you realize that this war story is also, but perhaps more important, a love story. So the film identifies itself, but I agree with you. I don't think they would have dared or were able to spell it out in that way when they made the film. This was a film made in a good deal of chaos and uncertainty. And you know, a lot of great moments ended up on the cutting floor. We're lucky that we have what we have, but some of them got dumped because they just didn't work in the way the film was turning out.
We're talking now with film historian David Thompson, who's just come out with a book, Moments That Made the Movies, a very personal list of favorite scenes from 72 films. No doubt you knew that some of your choices would meet with approval, a chorus of ahs from everybody flipping open the book, but that other choices might be considered curious, odd, debatable. How did you go about choosing?
I was determined on that. I mean, I knew that to make this book a whole that would intrigue people, there had to be a lot of scenes that they anticipated. So that if you ask people what scenes will be in this book, most people could list 10, let's say, that are going to be in the book. But then I wanted to throw in some things that maybe readers had never heard of, let alone seen. Because, you know, part of what I do and part of what a lot of film writers do is to say, well, okay, you know that, but have you seen that? You might like it. You know, I mean, this is a book that I hope is entertaining as a book, but I hope it will enlarge the experience people have in seeing the movies. All these movies are available today, somewhere or other, Netflix, Le Video, whatever. We live in an age of glory when you can see nearly everything that was ever made that has survived. But there's lots of stuff out there that people don't know. Most people who, when they look at the Netflix list or when they go to Le Video, I find, need help. All these titles are there, and they don't know which ones they might like. Well, what I do, and I think what most people in film criticism do, is try to make a map through the history of film where you can find your way to something you might like.
It is interesting. One's tempted to think in the age of the internet that everybody knows everything about every great film ever made. But the truth is we all have holes in our personal viewing history, movies that we haven't seen yet or maybe should see again.
Oh, I think that is so true. I was doing a pre-interview this week for this book with a 21-year-old. She was very smart, very amiable. And it turned out that she had not seen a single film that's in the book, you know? And I think that we're into an age now where film history has slipped away. There was a period during the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, where America as a whole really learned about its film history. They started watching old films. Television and video allowed that. But now we're through to another age where people just watch YouTube and things like that. And kids do not go to movies in quite the same way anymore. Movies have become, I think, much more a medium for the middle-aged and even older, if I can say older
Although
than middle-aged.
There are enthusiasts among the millennials and younger.
Absolutely. And, you know, you take something like Turner Classic Movies. It's clear that Turner Classic Movies depends on a fairly elderly, mature, let's say, audience now. And it's a very interesting question as to whether that will be replaced.
I also wonder, too, whether a lot of young people don't realize they're actually seeing references to older movies.
Absolutely.
Let's listen to a clip from a movie hopefully most of our listeners have seen, Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Here's Robert De Niro as Travis Bickle.
You talking to me? You talking to me? You talking to me?
For the benefit of those who haven't seen it, can you describe why this is actually a very menacing moment?
Well, Travis, who is a taxi driver, is not necessarily the cabbie you would hope to hire. He's living on a perilous, crumbling edge. He's psychotic. It's fairly clear he's going to do damage to himself or to someone pretty soon. And it's one of the great portraits of the psycho in American film. And, you know, De Niro does it fabulously. But that scene was not in the script. De Niro improvised that. It was very much in keeping with the script, Paul Schrader's script, a very good script. But, you know, De Niro and Scorsese were very familiar with each other. They worked with each other a lot, and they felt comfortable. And it's something that De Niro did on the set, the spur of the moment. And it's become a classic phrase. And as you say, people who have never seen the film will use it, and they don't quite know where it comes from, but it's passed into the culture.
It does seem that this is a classic example, if you will, of a moment that has become iconic precisely because of things beyond the film. The world around the film has become a more violent place. I have to say, every time I see yet another news report about somebody, you know, spraying a shopping mall with bullets, I think of this scene.
I agree totally. And that is what is so brilliant and prescient in it. It gets that possibility that in a sufficiently disturbed personality, he or she think they're in a movie already. And what they're going to go and do, act out, is kind of like a scene from a movie that fulfills their psychodrama. That's a very frightening aspect of what the movies have done to us, you know.
There's a sort of blurred interplay between fiction and reality.
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's hear a scene from Roman Polanski's Chinatown. This is the moment you chose in your book. We're not always sticking with the specific moments you chose. We all have our moments.
Yes.
In this clip, Jake Giddies, played by Jack Nicholson, is confronting the John Huston character.
There's going to be a lot of irate citizens when they find out that they're paying for water that they're not going to get.
Oh, that's all taken care of. See, Mr. Gibbs, either you bring the water to L.A., or you bring L.A. to the water.
How are you going to do that?
By incorporating the valley into the city. Simple as that.
How much are you worth?
I have no idea. How much do you want?
No, I just want to know what you're worth. Over 10 million?
Oh, my, yes.
Why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford?
The future, Mr. Gitz. The future. Now, where's the girl? I want the only daughter I've got left. As you found out, Evelyn was lost to me a long time ago.
Who do you blame for that, her?
I don't blame myself. See, Mr. Gitz, most people never have to face the fact that at the right time and the right place, they're capable of anything.
It's Chinatown, Jake.
Yeah.
You write in the book about this in the context of Raymond Chandler and his novel The Big Sleep. And then there's a translation the movie makes from the Chinatown of the 1930s to the 1970s. And of course, the film is coming out in the context of Watergate.
Yeah, it had so many different meanings when it came out. And of course, you know, it's the world of Raymond Chandler where all of a sudden, the private eye doesn't cut it anymore. Bogart playing Marlowe in The Big Sleep, say, is a superman. He's a very low-key superman, but you know he's going to succeed. He's going to get the girl. He's going to solve the problem. Jake Gittes is a private eye who is defeated by the system. And the really shocking thing about Chinatown when it came out, but it's still there, shocking, is that the villains go free. It's a very interesting turning point in the history of American film when we are grown up enough or cynical enough or despairing enough to realize that villains go free. And Noah Cross is exactly the kind of person who has built America. You know, I mean, we have plenty of Noah Crosses around today. And Polanski, to give him his great credit, looked at the screenplay of that film, which had a gentler ending, had a much kinder ending. And he said, no, we've got to have a tough ending. We've got to have a tough ending that fits our world. Now, that was 1974. Things have only got tougher since then. But the John Huston character, Noah Cross, really spells out, I think, that kind of cold-blooded, power mad system that has made the country what it is.
We really see, especially in the 1970s, as a reflection of the political times, the rise of the anti-hero
yes.
in film. But it's really changed since then. These days, the anti-hero you see tends to be somebody who goes to the dark side for whatever justifiable or unjustifiable reasons. And you see it a lot in current movies.
Yeah. And I think what's different about Chinatown is that it's very real. You felt that it was about L.A. in the 1930s, but it was about L.A. in the 70s, too, and it was really saying how our world works. Now, films have become much more fantasy-based than they were. The tremendous thing about the early 1970s, the era of The Godfather and so on, was that there was a kind of analysis of American society going on in these films, that for the first time, Hollywood was allowing to be made. It was because Hollywood was falling apart. If they really had the power they had once had, they would not have allowed it. I don't think you could make Chinatown now. But in that period, tough, interesting, brave directors, Coppola's generation, were doing things and saying things about the country that were amazing.
It was a golden age. No doubt you, the listener, have ideas about golden moments you want David Thompson to talk about. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Of course, you can also email us at forum@kqed, post on our Facebook page, tweet us. We're taking all comers. Let's talk about another golden age of film. Let's hear a clip from Morocco, starring Marlena Dietrich. This is her nightclub song. I'm not going to say the French phrase. David, why don't you set the stage for us?
Well, this is a Morocco made on the back lot of Hollywood. It's very dreamy. And Dietrich plays a cabaret entertainer. And you have the feeling that she's come to Morocco as almost the end of her road. And the big scene, the scene I talk about in the book, is not a sound scene, really, although she sings a song. But if you want to play the song, then I'll talk about what happens afterwards.
All right, let's do that. You know what struck me about watching this particular scene again? When this film comes out, it's 1930, and Marlena is shocking. She's wearing a man's suit. It's clear she's a sexual adventurer. So this moment, like so many, seems to strike a match because it is shocking.
Well, that's it. And what happens is she sings the song, there's applause, and she notices a very pretty, dark-haired young woman sitting at a table with a group of men, and she simply looks at her until the dark-haired young woman becomes a little embarrassed. She starts to blush and she starts to giggle, and the Dietrich character goes up to her and kisses her. And, you know, that was 1930, before the code. You couldn't have done it in a few years' time. But the extraordinary thing about it is, I think, that to this day, it's not exactly clear what the moment means. It's so ambiguous, and it's opening up a whole new area of sexuality and role-playing and gender in film. And it's a pioneering moment in films. And it's wonderful because literally, I think, even now, if you haven't seen the film, you're not sure what Dietrich is going to do. There's a real suspense in it.
You know, I wonder, it seems so many moments, both in your book and just generally, seem to strike a match because they cross a line that involves sex or violence. But it seems to me we've kind of played out most of the cards in that deck. Is there any place to go from here with shock value?
You've put your finger on a fascinating and disturbing question for people who do what I do, which is the movies, the sort of the classic form, is it drawing to a close? I agree with you. I think that just about every legitimate fantasy that we ever had, and the movies were always a way of exercising those fantasies, they've been played out. They've been tested. We have recently been able to commit murders through the characters on screen, and Travis is a pointer to that, in a way that once upon a time would have been impossible, absurd. I don't know where the fantasy goes, and I don't think filmmakers know, and I think it's a real issue and problem in terms of conceiving new story movies and what you do with it.
I suppose some creative people might say, well, what you do is reinterpret classic moments, classic ideas, and there's always a new way to say it. Getting to this point, Gary from Arizona writes,
yeah,
Children of Men, the battle scene near the end when the fighters realize the woman is holding an infant, and for a moment all action stops. I sobbed through the end of the film.
Absolutely. A moment that changes the nature of the film and also changes your position as a spectator. You were riding along on a certain kind of ride, loving the energy, and all of a sudden you realize that what you thought you were on a horse, you're in a car, something like that. Those are the moments where you are suddenly made aware of just how potent watching a movie can be.
And surprised that, you know, yet another battle scene, but this director, this writer, these actors make it new, something new.
Yeah. The other novelty that's always going to come along is that of technology. The thing that has kept changing the movies has been the technological expansion of the medium. And I think we all know and feel we're at a moment where the technology is exploding and changing. And I don't know where it's going to go, but I think that's where the change and the novelty will come.
We're talking with David Thompson, who's written a book full of gorgeous photos about his favorite movie moments. Don't let him hog the stage or me. Join the conversation with your favorites. Call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, post on our Facebook page, or head to our website, kqed.org/forum. Whatever your mode of communication, we're ready for your comments and questions. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro, talking with film critic David Thompson about his latest book, Moments That Made the Movies, a series of love letters to his favorite scenes from 72 films. We've asked our listeners to call in, to write in, and so they have. Let's start with Derek, who writes, with all the talk about Dread Pirate Roberts this week, what does David Thompson think about The Princess Bride? There are so many memorable and quotable lines.
Well, I haven't seen it for a long time, but I remember it as being an enormously entertaining film. There isn't a moment from that in the book, but it's an interesting film in that I think it had an unexpected success. I don't think when it came out it was necessarily perceived how deeply it was going to go into people's consciousness. And that is very telling about us and our history, that some films last and some don't. I happened to see last night part of Kramer versus Kramer, which was a hugely successful film when it came out. And I looked at it last night and I thought it was insufferable. I thought it was just overdone and it hadn't lasted at all. You know what I mean? Now, that was my opinion. Some people might still think it's great. But then other films from way back beyond, from the 30s, suddenly spring to life. And one of the great things about the Silent Film Festival in this town is the rediscovery that a film made in a very, very different technology, almost archaic in its emotions and feelings, can be just stunning. And you can't calculate how things are going to last.
It is true, though, that a lot of people these days will go to an ancient movie, ancient plug in the decade you want to plug in, and they'll be laughing at the wrong things or the silliness of it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I took one of my sons to see The Exorcist when it was reissued, I don't know, about 12 years ago, whatever. Now, I was terrified when I first saw The Exorcist. Terrified. And I was an adult. And I was a little nervous about taking my son to it. He laughed at it. He thought it was ridiculous. And I'm not blaming The Exorcist for that, because these things happen. Films are made for a particular weekend, if you know what I mean. They open at a particular weekend, and that's when they make their fame or not. And as I say, some of them just don't last at all. Some of them last so much better than you would have dreamed.
Along those lines, for this segment, I ended up rewatching part of A Star Is Born. This is a film, 1954, starring Judy Garland.
Right.
It's the scene where she sings "The Man That Got Away." Can you set this up for us?
Yeah, she plays a supposedly young singer performer at the beginning of her career, and she has been part of a big charity show where her skill and her grace has enabled the drunken star, Norman Maine, to get off the stage without making a complete idiot of himself. And he's touched by this, and he goes in search of her to say thank you. And he finds her with a group of musicians just jamming in a back room in a bar. And this incredible Harold Arlen song is what she sings. Are you going to play that number?
Yes,
great.
Let's do it.
Good.
Take it, honey. Come on. Take it from the top.
From the top?
Yeah.
The night is bitter, the stars have lost their glitter, the winds grow colder, suddenly you're older, and all because of the man.
I wish we had the time to play the whole song. She is such a raw talent, and it's worth saying, 1954, there were no digital fixes of her voice. She sounded like that.
She did it over a period of about 3 days. She filmed it, I forget the exact number, well over 20 times, and she asked for a 15-minute break between each version. And the other thing about it was on playback, so she did not actually have to sing. All she had to do was move her mouth. But she was such a heartfelt singer. She sang the song every time. And you can hear there the thing that's maybe wrong with the film. Garland is a very mature person. She was only 31, I think, at the time. But 31 well-filled years.
Hard-lived years,
and
yeah.
It's a torch song. And this is a woman who's been through the mill. She's playing a character who supposedly should be 20 or something like that.
An ingenue.
Yes, an ingenue. But a great, great song, and one of the I mean, one of the loveliest moments in the book for me.
That is something you see through the history of film, or musical performances with raw talent that just blows you away, regardless of the rest of the film, whether it's a good one or bad one.
Well, absolutely, yeah. And particularly with musicals, I think, that because the story in musicals, I mean, the collected stories of the Astaire Rogers films, who wants to know? But the numbers are what stick out. And of course, here's the other interesting thing where the technology has come to our aid. If you love Top Hat, say, or I don't know, Broadway Melody of 1940, you don't have to bother with the whole silly story. The DVD will let you go to the number. So that a lot of people these days do not watch whole movies. They watch moments. That's another reason for this book, that the moments have become crucial to our pleasure.
It's a very interesting point. Let's turn to the phones now. And Terry in Oakland.
Hi. Your conversation reminds me of a movie I saw called My Brilliant Career. And I saw it, I think it was in the late 70s, early 80s. And it was about this young woman who was born to the peasant class. This movie was set, I think, in the 19th century, maybe mid-19th century. And she was not very happy about it. She was very bright and capable. And every assignment that she was sent to, you know, as a servant or something like that, she always, you know, was resistant. So anyway, the movie's about that. And during this movie, quietly, there's this drought going on that's maybe it's mentioned once or twice. And then suddenly it begins to rain. And so Sybilla is this white woman with this long red wild hair, and everybody's just blown away because finally it's raining, and she's so happy that with all her layers of gowns and, you know, skirts and stuff on, she lays down in the mud and cries in the rain, and it was just so powerful. It was sort of so out of nowhere. I don't remember who wrote it, but it was called My Brilliant Career, and I believe it was a French subtitled movie.
It's an Australian film, I think.
Maybe so. Maybe it was.
We'll look that up while we're talking.
Yeah.
This brings out a point, you know, a lot of the best films in history are not in English.
Well, that's okay, too.
It is.
A lot of people speak other languages. Once upon a time, the movie spoke no language at all. That's when they had a really universal language.
And, of course, there is the language of visuals. I'm thinking, of course, of one of the scenes that you mention in the book, A Touch of Evil. You include really what a lot of filmmakers consider one of cinema's most famous scenes, the opening tracking shot of Orson Welles' Touch of Evil.
Yeah.
Let's hear that soundtrack by Harry Mancini. So for some people, they're going to hear that music and immediately visualize a stunning shot. Can you describe it for us?
Well, it's an unbroken shot. It begins with a person putting a bomb under a car, and the camera then cranes back and starts the action where the car will cross the Mexican-American border. And at the same time, two of the leading characters in the film, played by Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh, who've just been married, will cross the border too. And obviously, if there's a bomb, it's going to explode. And that's the end of the shot. The shot ends as the bomb explodes. And it is one of the most famous, showy openings to a film. And you have to remember that Orson Welles at that time he'd been in Europe for a long time. He had been written off by a lot of people in Hollywood. And it was quite clear, I think, that he said, well, I'm coming back. I'm going to do this film. And I'm going to knock their socks off right at the beginning with the most extraordinary scene they've ever had the chance to see. Because, you know, he was a brilliant, brilliant man. And it is very showy, but it works always. And I love the Henry Mancini music. Later on, the soundtrack was changed and sort of real local Mexican-American music was put on the
with
film.
With the restoration
and
years.
I don't quite like it as much as this very sort of big beat, trashy kind of score, because I think that suits the pulpy nature of it rather better.
Let's read some more from listeners. Here's some favorite movie scenes coming in over Twitter. Tim Robbins' triumphant, rain-baptized escape in Shawshank Redemption. Yeah. I think of it whenever I leave jury duty. David writes, Omar Sharif's entrance in Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, one of the great shots. Yeah,
Best entrance ever, he says. Yeah. It's so rare that movies take the time to let the scene unfold naturally.
Yeah, and of course that was made by David Lean, who always, I think, was a little uncomfortable with talk and dialogue. He was always looking for visuals that would say anything and more than dialogue could. And the idea of this dark figure coming out of the shimmering distance in the desert, you get the feeling of the desert, you get the sense of hostility, of the strangeness of cultures. It's all there visually. And you know, he's one of many, many directors who I think are more comfortable seeing something than saying something.
Speaking the language of film.
Yes.
Alex writes, what moment is more memorable than the lightsaber illuminated silhouettes of Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader in the original Star Wars? What child hasn't acted that out with a sibling or friend on the playground countless times?
Oh, you bet. And of course, that's a huge part of the impact of films, that kids go home and act the films out. And whatever age you are, there will be a certain film or two you probably saw when you were 8 or 9, something like that. And you know the swordplay movements or the gunplay movements inside out.
We live it. The movies become part of our personal
Absolutely,
history.
Absolutely, yes.
Let's turn now to Gary in Sacramento.
Hi. I'd like to nominate a line from Pretty Woman when Julia Roberts and Richard Gere are getting ready to set out on their first date, and she turns to him and says, in case I forget to tell you later, I had a wonderful time tonight. I can't imagine anybody that arranges a date that wouldn't be flattered to hear something like that from their partner.
Pretty Woman is a fascinating film because it went through huge troubles during the making. Many, many changes in direction and how they were going to play it. Because I think a lot of the people behind the film were very uneasy about it, the way it sort of endorsed prostitution and that kind of thing. And yet, what nobody quite realized, I think, was that Julia Roberts then had an energy and a charm that were going to ride over all these problems. And she is just so endearing. It is one of the last great star introductions, I think, in the history of the movies.
It's true. Sometimes it's just about the performance. I mean, I suppose the performance on the backs of all the professionals that made that moment possible.
Sure. But you know, you cannot beat the way we, the crowd, fall in love with certain people. And there are great actors who've made many films and the public never fell in love with them. And there are other people who, not nearly as good as actors, but from the moment it began. And Julia Roberts is a very good example. It just happened. People sort of said, I want to see more of her. And a career was born.
I think many people might say that they've seen a lot of Meryl Streep over the years, but there's a reason why. She's a phenomenal actress. And so here's one of my favorite scenes. It's one that's not in your book, from the movie The Devil Wears Prada. Meryl Streep plays a powerful fashion magazine editor, Miranda Priestly. This film was, released in 2006, The Devil Wears Prada.
Oh, okay. I see. You think this has nothing to do with you. You go to your closet, and you select, I don't know, that lumpy blue sweater, for instance, because you're trying to tell the world that you take yourself too seriously to care about what you put on your back. But what you don't know is that that sweater is not just blue, it's not turquoise, it's not lapis, it's actually cerulean. And you're also blithely unaware of the fact that in 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a collection of cerulean gowns, and then I think it was Yves Saint Laurent, wasn't it, who showed cerulean military jackets? I think we need a jacket here.
Mm.
And then cerulean quickly showed up in the collections of 8 different designers. And then it filtered down through the department stores and then trickled on down into some tragic casual corner where you no doubt fished it out of some clearance bin. However, that blue represents millions of dollars and countless jobs. And it's sort of comical how you think that you've made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry when in fact you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room from a pile of stuff.
Just what a command performance. She holds the stage.
She does. But now tell me this. Do you love Meryl Streep?
Yes.
You do? Because I think a lot of people don't quite love her. I think a lot of people over the years have felt her command, her skill, and don't quite get the naturalness, the vitality. I'm not blaming her for that. I think she's a magnificent actress, and I think she's made some prodigious films. But a less skilled actress, like Julia Roberts, let's say, clearly, for a moment in her career, I don't think it went on forever, but for a moment, she just grabbed people, both sexes, grabbed their love, their affection. And I'm not sure that Streep has ever done that. And it may be that Streep simply doesn't want to do it, you know.
And yet you chose a scene from a movie she was in, Sophie's Choice.
That's not in the book. But that's okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, that scene in Sophie's Choice could easily have been in the book because it comes from the novel. But it is... It's probably one of the most terrifying scenes in film where she has to choose between her two children, which will survive. And I think a lot of actresses would be terrified of trying that. And it speaks to her courage, not just that she took it on, but that she did it so superbly.
It is interesting the parallels between film and stage. Certainly film is not stage, and many people who succeed on stage do not succeed
right.
in film.
Right. No, absolutely.
Let's turn to another phone call. Thomas in Sonoma County.
Welcome to Sherwood. So I heard somewhere that, this is a few years ago, that The Adventures of Robin Hood was shown on TV more than any other film and had probably been seen more than any other film. And I wondered if your guest could explain why. What is it about that one?
I don't know that that's true, but it could be. I certainly wouldn't dispute it.
1938, Errol Flynn.
Yeah, I mean, it is an example of a kind of clean-cut adventure that I think appealed to adults as much as it did to children, that we just don't really know how to do anymore. We don't have the confidence for it. If you looked at that film today, the Errol Flynn Robin Hood, you would say, well, it's a film for children. But truly, when it came out, it was a film for all ages. I think another thing about that film that is, well, two things I can think of. It has a fantastic score by Eric Korngold, and the Technicolor, only a couple of years after Technicolor began, it looks like stained glass windows. It's just superb to look at. And, you know, it's one of the most enjoyable films. It's not that it's got hidden meanings and subtexts, but you just have such a hell of a good time with it.
Beautifully put. Great suggestion, Thomas.
Yeah.
I should mention, you're based here in San Francisco, and so, of course, you're going to be at a number of events starting tomorrow, the Mill Valley Film Festival.
Right, yeah.
At noon as part of the Insight Program at the Rafael Film Center. At Books, Inc. in the Castro on Tuesday.
Yes.
At the Mechanics Institute Library on Wednesday. You're making the rounds.
I better make a note of all this. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I've got the list here for you.
Okay.
Book Passage in Corte Madera on October 25th. The folks who come to these events, are you seeing young people?
Oh, yeah. I think when you go to somewhere like the Mill Valley Film Festival, for instance, you're going to get a very mixed audience. I think if you go to bookstores, you get much older audiences. And I think that, you know, that factor in the audience, the structure of the audience, is something that everybody who's in this business has got to pay attention to. Yeah, yeah. I have a 19-year-old who's just started college, and he's doing film classes. And, you know, he was raised at our house. His mother knows as much about film as I know. And he called me the other day, and he wanted to check something that he was doing for a paper. And I was drawn to say, well, you know, it's a bit like Cary Grant. And he said, who? And I suddenly realized that his 19 years of life, I had not made the impression that I thought I would make.
Well, maybe you just presumed that information was so basic.
Parents always presume too much. Yes, yes.
From Facebook, Shiloh writes, one of my favorite movie moments is at the end of The Third Man.
Oh, yeah.
That long walk toward the camera in one unbroken shot was almost shocking to watch.
And that moment is in the book.
That moment is in the book.
Yes.
Thank you, Shiloh. Mabel writes, Susan Sarandon to Burt Lancaster in Atlantic City. Teach me stuff.
Great choice. Great choice. Very, very underrated film, I think, too. It's kind of slipped away. Hugely pleasant film. And yeah, Teach Me Stuff. You know, that's another thing about the movies. The movies, once upon a time, taught young people how to live, taught young people how to smoke, how to kiss, how to walk, things like that. Very, very basic things. And I don't know whether that still happens, but I'd be sorry to think it didn't.
It seems like there's a kind of hyper-realism today where, you know, we basically cut from the, you know, first glance to the morning after without any of the middle stuff in between. A presumption,
right.
We know what should have happened between there.
I mean, some films today, I think, are saying, teach me to be a special effect.
Or to stand in front of a green screen.
Right, right.
Barbara writes, so often it is the music in movies that makes them memorable for me, such as Singing in the Rain or Meet Me in St. Louis. This is Judy Garland again.
Absolutely,
of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she wonders, aren't there, you know, alas, there aren't many memorable musicals being made. Do you have any recent favorites?
Well, that's a great question. When you say recent, I'm not sure what you mean. But I am reminded, and I will put a plug in for a friend show, opening any day now in San Francisco is Beautiful, the Carole King story. And I know very well Doug McGrath, who wrote the book for it. And that is an old-fashioned musical on stage. It's about a singer. You know, that classic subject. It's about a singer making it and discovering herself. I love Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which is already 50 years old. I enjoyed Yentl very much.
Do you ever watch anything from Bollywood?
From
Bollywood. I mean, the Indians still love, you know, big dance numbers.
I mean, I think I'm just a stick in the mud where that's concerned, because I kind of feel I'm too old to learn about that.
And yet there's so much joy and energy.
I know.
It reminds me like of Bugsby Berkeley, the MGM musical days.
Exactly. I guess I'm too much of me has got Bugsby Berkeley in my genes, I think.
You know, it was interesting going through the 72 films you reference in moments that made the movies. A lot of the older films, I was like, check, check, check. I grew up in a household where this was, you know, standard procedure to watch many of the film classics. As we get, though, towards the modern age, you made more, I guess you could say, idiosyncratic choices, films that a lot of people may not have watched or be familiar with. The Zodiac, The Piano Teacher.
Yeah, well, The Piano Teacher is a deeply, deeply disturbing film, and I do make that clear in the book. I think it's a great film. And of course, the director of that film would go on to make Amour, which is a much better known film. Zodiac is a mystery because I thought Zodiac was going to be a hit. I thought that it was the kind of thriller that everybody was intrigued by, and it didn't really work, although there are some extraordinary things in it, and I do talk about the end scene of that film.
James writes, one moment that really got to me was the scene in The Whale Rider, in which the young girl sings a traditional Maori song, and her grandfather isn't there. The camera stays on her the whole time as tears stream down her face. I felt as embarrassed and sympathetic for her as I would have been if I had been there in person.
That's it. That's what we want. Yeah, yeah.
Lisa writes on Facebook, I can't help but think of Darth Vader. Again, Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father, Luke Skywalker. He told me enough. He told me you killed him, Darth Vader. No, I am your father. Yeah. It was an eye-opener to facing reality of those we look up to never being as perfect as we fantasize.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, the Star Wars story is so interesting because the original, the first two or three, were films that changed the medium. And yet, when George Lucas came back to do the second three, it was as if he'd sort of lost the feeling for them. You know? I mean, that's what I felt. The excitement of them, it just didn't seem to be there anymore.
I guess that's a challenge for him to go back and do some
more films. I don't know whether he will. Yeah.
Film critic David Thompson talking about his latest book, Moments That Made the Movies. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineers have been Danny Bringer and Rob Spate. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and the executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.